Lord Vader, Operation Andor is underway.
Excellent. If we release 3 episodes per week, the Lorehounds will never be able to cover every episode. The Imperial forces will crush the rebellion before it begins.
Stand by. We're picking up something on our scanners.
Echo Squadron, reporting in.
Delta Squadron, on your left.
Django Squadron, on your 6.
With Imperial forces coming in fast, we're calling all Rebels to join the fight this season. Starting after the April 22nd premiere, you'll hear 3 full breakdowns for each week's episodes of Andor Season 2. Each podcast will be led by one of our squadron leaders, Alicia, David, and John. We'll be bringing in new and familiar voices to fill out the roster. Search for the Lorehounds on any podcast platform to join us in a galaxy far, far away. And don't forget to check out our season pass for even more content like our Holocron bonus pods. It's good news for anyone, except Darth Vader.
I'm not exactly a tech genius, but I knew one thing for sure. If I wanted my small business to crush it, I needed a website that worked like a pro, and I needed it yesterday. Lucky for me, Bluehost made it ridiculously easy. With their AI design tools, building my website was a walk in the park. I could customize, optimize, and monetize everything exactly how I wanted. In just a few minutes, I had a secure site up and running. I couldn't believe how straightforward it was. And getting found online? Bluehost helped me with that, too. I perfected my keywords and meta descriptions with their search engine tools. The AI even gave me suggestions to improve my pages. Now I can sit back, relax, and focus on my customers, while my website continues to rank higher and higher on Google. With their 30-day money-back guarantee, I wasn't worried about taking the plunge. And now I'm so glad I did. Head over to Bluehost.com and build something special today.
Want to keep your personal number private but still stay connected? With Line 2, you can get a second phone line right on your device with a super simple app and no need for another phone. Whether it's for online shopping, dating, or shielding your main number from spam, Line 2 is an easy way to manage it all. Ready for peace of mind without breaking the bank? Call, text, block, and more for only $9.99. Get started with line2.com/audio or download Line 2 in any app store today. Line 2, your second line simplified.
Welcome to the Wheel of Time podcast. We're the Lorehounds, your guides to all things Randland. I'm David.
I'm John, and this is our podcast for the Wheel of Time on Prime Video.
In this episode, we're going to be talking to Dr. Michael Livingston about his new book, Origins of the Wheel of Time, as well as introducing our plans for covering the Wheel of Time once Amazon gets us a release date.
Before we get started, here's a quick reminder that you can send feedback to WOT@thelorehounds.com. Or if you want to talk Wheel of Time with us sooner, head over to the Bald Move Discord server. Link is in the description below and at baldmove.com.
If you're enjoying our coverage of the Wheel of Time or any of the other shows we've been covering, and you would like to support us directly, head over to our Patreon page at patreon.com/thelorehounds. For just $3 a month, you can subscribe today and get early and ad-free access to every one of our podcasts.
Another quick ask. If you have a minute, please help us play the long game on Apple Podcasts and leave us a rating and review. Really helps us get recognized by more people, which helps us make more podcasts. Now, David, before we get into the Wheel of Time, why don't we talk about some programming notes?
Sounds good. First up, next Wednesday, we're going to be covering the finale of Mike White's masterpiece, The White Lotus Season 2. Then, on Monday, December 19th, we'll be launching our new occasional podcast, MC Universe, to talk Black Panther and the end of Phase 4, and what to expect with the coming of Phase 5.
Very cool. Well, David, we've got a lot more coming from the Lorehounds this month, but we'll tell you more about that at the close of the show. For now, why don't we talk about what our plans are for the Wheel of Time coverage?
Sounds good. Yeah, we were expecting, I think, Season 1 to drop initially this year, but then it was the big battle between House of the Dragon and Rings of Power, and it seems like Amazon is delaying the announcement of when they're going to start Season 2. So we've got plans for Season 2.
So the plan is to do full coverage of Season 2, where we do the same thing that we do for all these shows we've done lately, which is we do some themes, we do some background research maybe, and then we get into a full episode recap and listener feedback. And I'm really excited to talk about this stuff. Wheel of Time is a huge passion for me. I've read all the books. I've read some of them twice. I'm probably going to read them again more before it comes out. So really excited to get into this with you, David. And then for season one, I know we have a little bit of uncertainty for that because it depends on what coverage looks like next year. We're waiting to see if we're going to be covering certain shows. If it works out on the schedule, we'll go back and cover season one fully. But if not, then we'll do at least a recap.
Yeah. And we have both seen season one a couple of times, and we've got some stuff on the cutting room floor that we recorded pretty early on in our podcast careers. I don't know, maybe we'll release that someday as a, a crazy Patreon release or something. It's pretty horrible.
I had COVID during that recording.
That's true.
I literally
That's
had
right.
COVID.
Right.
It was not a good recording.
So yeah, so whether once we know what Amazon's going to do, it would be great to have a full season one back catalog in coverage, but that takes a lot of time and it doesn't get a lot of traction for us generally. So it's really just a question of like what we've got going on and when Amazon actually gives us a date. But I wouldn't mind doing a full season episode by episode recap, but I guess we'll just have to see.
Yeah, me either. And it will be a much bigger joy to go through those episodes with this new book in hand that we're going to talk about today.
Yeah.
This new book by Michael Livingston, I just can't get enough of it. It is called Origins of the Wheel of Time. It is a reference book and sort of a history book on how Robert Jordan, the author of The Wheel of Time, approached the writing of this world and the world building. It's so cool, and this professor is just fascinating. He's really into all this stuff. He is into linguistics as well. He's an expert on Tolkien. He's an expert on Jordan, and I hope that you'll stick around to hear what he has to say today.
Yeah, I had a really good time talking with him, and I hope we can talk with him more once the season gets started. I remember when I heard on another podcast, he was interviewed. And I texted you, or I Discord messaged you, and I said, oh, do you know about this book? And you were like, yeah, I've already got it on pre-order.
Yep. So
it's on my Bald Move Secret Santa wish list. So by the time this comes out, I may or may not have gotten that gift. So we'll see. But yeah, it looks like a very cool book. I'm excited to get it myself. If I don't get it on the Secret Santa gift exchange, then I'll probably just buy a copy myself. But it looks great. And for somebody who like me, who is a non-book reader, I think it'll be kind of nice to use as a companion guide as we're going through, where I can just sort of pick out little bits of information. I'm not too worried about spoilers for myself. Mm-hmm. So it'll be fun for me to pick through some of this information that he's compiled about the real-world historical references that fed into Jordan's constructing all of the mythology for Wheel of Time. And I think that's really cool because taking inspiration from the real world, like there's no more weirder and wilder stuff. You can't imagine stuff, you know, that has really gone on in real life. Like you just can't believe the kinds of crazy things that are contained in human history. And I think it's cool. I've been enjoying learning more about Jordan and his process, about how he was so inspired by human history, and then he wove all of this stuff into his stories.
You do like your weaves, and that's a big part of the Wheel of Time.
I do.
So this is the series for you, David.
Yes, absolutely. I am. I'm totally into the weaving thing now, aren't I?
Are you going to start quilting?
No, I hope not. Maybe. I don't know. We'll see.
Find out on Second Breakfast if David has started quilting. You'll have to be a patron to learn that, but... Yeah, no, I'm excited to talk about this more. We already did our interview. We're recording this later, and it was just such an excellent interview, and I hope everyone takes the time to listen.
Yeah, absolutely. It was a cool thing, and fingers crossed we'll have Dr. Livingston back again in the not-too-distant future.
Very cool. When we get back, we will have Dr. Livingston. Okay, with us today is Dr. Michael Livingston of The Citadel, author of Origins of the Wheel of Time. Michael, how are you today?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for coming on. I just read your book this week. It was excellent, and I'm really excited to dig into this with you.
I'm so glad you enjoyed it. Appreciate it.
Yeah, you know, I'm a huge fan of the Wheel of Time. I had to convince David to cover the series with me. We generally cover TV over here, but I'm a big fan of the Wheel of Time books. Of course, season one was a little shaky compared to the books, which, you know, I think are great all the way through. So we're excited for season two, and in the interim, before season two starts, we're digging a little deeper into the books here. And so we wanted to hear all about your new book. It came out November 8th. And it's available now wherever you get your books. And we'll drop a link to Michael's website in the description. So, Michael, if you could tell us, what was your inspiration behind Origins?
So, great question. This is a book that is, I like to kind of say, outworld focus as opposed to in-world focus. So, one of the great things about the Wheel of Time is its depth, right? It's complexity, the depth of the cultures, the histories that he's built. You know, the amazing family trees, all this stuff. It's so expansive and kind of realized, you know, which makes sense. It's like 4.4 million words or whatever it is, you know, like it's a lot. And right. And so it has this amazing kind of in-world quality. And we've had great resources for that. The Wheel of Time Companion, for instance, the World of Robert Jordan's Wheel of Time, called The White Book. That sort of detail that material. But one of the things that's interesting about Jordan is the way that he used our world to create that. And, you know, this is something that I've always gravitated towards. You know, I'm a historian and a, you know, literary specialist of the medieval world. You know, cut my teeth on Tolkien. And this is something Tolkien did, kind of looking backwards. And has been, you know, kind of really, really, you know, kind of shaped Tolkien studies is this idea of how he's using the past. And I've written on that and gone to the Tolkien archives and all that. And, you know, Jordan's doing the same kind of thing. And nobody was talking about it in a sort of gathered up kind of academic, like, you know, let's like really show this to people. There are websites, there's some amazing websites that have talked about this. And I've done lectures over the years, but never had kind of been pulled all together into one sort of, you know, public facing, here's what he was doing. So I was kind of, you know, picked to do this, and it was amazing thing to do.
Yeah, you know, you mentioned you were picked to do this. I know the Team Jordan was very involved. They hand selected you to dig into this work. How was it working with Harriet McDougall?
An absolute honor. I mean, you know, Harriet is one of the greatest scientists.
Who is Harriet?
Harriet is the widow of Robert Jordan. Oh, okay. Was actually first his editor.
Right.
And one of the greatest science fiction and fantasy editors kind of all time. I mean, she edited Ender's Game, like among a plethora of amazing works. And so, yeah, getting to work with her was amazing.
So was she an editor in her own right before she married Jordan?
Yes. Yes.
Got it. Okay.
She was his editor, and then...
And then they got married.
And then they got married.
Wow, that's pretty awesome.
Yeah. Yeah. So she's the kind of founding editor of Tor Books. And that's how they sort of got to know each other. I go through the entire kind of... it's a beautiful love story. Of the two of them, and I go through that in my biography of Jordan that kind of starts the book, because it is so integral then to the creation of the Wheel of Time is kind of Harriet's sort of force behind this, and I wanted to highlight that for people. And so, yeah, the opportunity to work with work with her, to get edits from her, you know, that was crazy, right? You know, to get like her hand edits on pages. I'm like, my God, she edited Ender's Game, like, and she's editing my stuff. Like, what is going on? And
did you get all fanboy?
Yeah, I was totally fanboy. I fanboyed constantly in the making of this. I mean, to be given full access to all the notes, all like everything that he had touched, and everyone, right? You know, do you want to talk to Tom Doherty of Tor Books? Yeah. Here you go. You know, you want to talk to Brandon Sanderson? Here you go. You want to talk to, like, it was just, and you know, here's the call list. Who do you want to talk to? What do you want to see? And then to have the kind of the track of Harriet and Team Jordan, his assistants, all to be able to say, you know, yeah, we think this is correct. Like, you know, yeah, this is right, to help me feel like, you know, I'm not in kind of off on my own here. Right. I've got all this authorization essentially behind me. It's crazy.
It's fascinating because it seems like they sort of handed you the Christopher Tolkien keys, whereas Christopher was, you know, given full access to his father's work after his passing and was able to do whatever he wanted with it. It seems like you've sort of gotten to take up that mantle a little bit with Jordan.
Yeah. And that was very much kind of like the model. Again, I, you know, as an academic, I mean, I've published a lot on Tolkien and have some choice thoughts for Christopher, but,
911.
You can give us your hot takes here. I mean, we're our mics are open.
Yeah. Don't speak ill of the past. It was kind of like that.
I would say that there's a place for valid critique and criticism as opposed to throwing fire and feces just for the sake of throwing fire and feces. So
yeah, and I would never want to do that. I mean, I just, you know, I've having worked in the Tolkien archives and had to try and negotiate things and stuff. There's like a
sensitivity.
You went left, you should have gone right, and you went left for what I consider invalid reasons. But
interesting.
But yeah,
okay.
It was that kind of full access, and the book I've got thousands of words, unpublished words of Jordan that, you know, I mean, there, what a key difference that is, you know, with working in the Tolkien archives, you know, I have to sign all kinds of NDAs about what I've seen there. And then to try and presenting that stuff for an academic audience, for a public audience, right? You know, like, here's this piece of information that would be really useful. Am I allowed to do that? Right. And then it goes to what used to go to Christopher, you know, and they're like, nope, can't ever tell us all. Like, no, you don't get to tell anybody. Okay. Right. As opposed to here, you know, and you're like, this is a sentence. Like, I want to quote a sentence out of a letter. Like, are you kidding? Why are you withholding this? It makes no sense. Like,
right.
People want to know who that character really is. And there's the smoking gun. And in this case, it was the complete opposite, where I would say, you know, can I quote this? Like, in one case, I give, like, I don't know how many words in a row it is, right? But a first draft of one of the chapters of the first book, a huge chunk of it. And when I asked permission for that, I thought, oh, there's no way they're going to let me give this whole chunk, right? But I'll ask for the big chunk on the assumption that they'll be like, all right, we'll compromise here. Instead, they're like, yeah, go ahead and do the whole chunk. Oh, okay. This is phenomenal. So the level of access and the freedom to, I guess, to kind of say what I felt needed to be said without there being somebody kind of watching over and saying, well, we don't want you to say that because we feel like that's going to make, you know, the estate look bad or whatever. I mean, not that, I don't think there was anything like that, but it just never came. And that was such a wonderful experience as a researcher and a writer, to feel like I was completely unfettered, that all I was getting was support. And if there was a correction or whatever, it was because it was a correction, right? As opposed to a, no, like, we're not going to allow that. You know, it was like, no, here's this other piece of information, you know, which is exactly what you would want in a case like this. So yeah, it was amazing.
That's really great to hear. I mean, you can tell when you read it how open Harriet and the rest of Team Jordan were with the works, and how useful they were as a,
yes,
as a boon rather than a blockade. And that's really great to see. You know, when I opened your book, I expected to find a lot of details, a lot of trivia that would be helpful to my reading of The Wheel of Time, to my coverage of The Wheel of Time. What I didn't expect to find was possibly the best defense of fantasy as an academic study that I've ever read. So you gave this really excellent defense of this as a field of speculative fiction, if you will, and of fantasy and magic as something that deserves to have its own attention by serious critics. Can you talk more about that?
Happy to. So when I was in graduate school, you know, fantasy was like, that's not serious, right? You know, like that's not literature, right? Quote unquote, capital L. And that always really ticked me off. And while I was in graduate school, Tolkien studies started kind of like coalescing and being valid for at least kind of like part of the world, right? I mean, there were still people that were like, no, you know, nose in the air kind of thing. But Tolkien studies was kind of happening. And a large part of that due to like Tom Shippey, his amazing work, you know, Road to Middle Earth and Author of the Century. Tom's incredible. You know, and sort of that paving of the way was amazing and great for Tolkien. But even so, you know, I remember at the University of Rochester, I wanted to teach a class for the undergraduates on Tolkien. And there was real resistance, you know, like, well, that's not real literature, right? I was actually, that's not real literature and nobody would take it anyway. And it's like, they would. And also it's real literature, right? And finally got to teach that class, and it crashed the servers. people trying to roll up for it.
That's
and
awesome.
They hadn't put a cap on the class. So they had thought, well, maybe the class will make with 10, you know, whatever. And it ended up being 100 students, like in an auditorium. Like it was just bonkers, which I was like, I told you, right? And, you know, and then when I came to the Citadel, which was Jordan's alma mater.
Is that the Citadel, the military academy in the Carolinas?
Yes, the Military College of South Carolina.
Right, okay, thank you.
Yeah, and there was kind of a, you know, like, you know, is the Wheel of Time. It was just like Tolkien had been, you know, like 20 years earlier kind of thing. The same thing, and it really bothered me. And then when Jordan was going to be inducted into the South Carolina Academy of Authors, and he had just died. Fortunately, he knew that he had been awarded this before his death, but the induction had not taken place. And the induction took place on my campus, and I was asked. They said, "Well, can you talk? Because you know his work. You're a professor, you know, and you're a professor here. That'll all look really good. Would you be willing to do that?" And I'm like, "Yeah, of course. I mean, you're kidding. I'll talk about him to anybody anywhere, sure." And then somebody told me, and I don't know if this is true, but somebody said, you know, there are some people that aren't really sure, you know, South Carolina Academy of Authors is, you know, sort of has a literary acknowledgement to it, right? And you know, does this really count because it's fantasy? And I don't know if that's true, but I was told that there had been this like, well, he did sell, you know, at that point, 40 million books or whatever. Nah, you know, I guess we got it. So I took that speech as an opportunity to have a to make a defense, you know, like this is 100% literature, right? If you're saying fantasy isn't literature, like you just threw out Homer, you just threw out Beowulf, you just threw it, like, do you want to know what you just burned down, you idiots? You know, like, and again, I really don't know if there were people in that place who felt that way, but that's.
Do you think that that's something that's related between antiquity and modernism? Well, it's modern, therefore, it hasn't stood the test of time, whereas Homer is antiquity, and therefore.
I think there's this bizarre separation
mm-hmm.
that happens where yeah, you're allowed to, it's allowed to be fantastic if it's back then.
Right.
But not now. But it can be fantastic now if you don't call it magic realism and now it's okay.
Right.
You're like, what? Like I'm like, what now? I'm sorry, that's still a fantasy. Like that's you've labeled it different.
Right.
I don't know what's going on. Did you actually read Borges or not? Because it's fantasy. So yeah, I mean, there is something to that, you know, that like, oh, it's okay to talk about monsters if it's ancient or medieval. We don't do that anymore, except we do that still, but in this category, and so now it counts. And then I thought, you know, and I just have no patience for that.
Frankly. Can I chase for a second this idea too of, okay, you know, fantasy as literature, cool. Science fiction as literature, ... And then what's the difference between science fiction and fantasy? Are we doing the same things? Or where, what's the fulcrum or the pivot point between science fiction and fantasy?
I don't see one.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, I really don't see one. All these things are ideas of spectrum.
Uh-huh.
Right? I mean, you know, the Heart of Darkness did not happen. Like, on a pretty basic level, it's a fantasy, right? He made that
You're
up.
You're talking
right?
about Conrad. Up,
yeah, Joseph right, Conrad, yeah. right? You know, I mean, he made that up. Like, that's not real.
Right.
Lord of the Flies, not real. Like, made the whole thing up. Like, so just, it's like a spectrum of how much are you making up, right? How much are you making up? Well, now I'm making up the landscape, right? Now I'm making up the technology. Now I'm making up, all right, well, we're just moving that line. It's not really substantially a different thing. Now, there's not to say the categories are not like utilitarian in a functional way, right? It is useful if you really like this kind of thing to have a category for that flavor of it, right?
Classical versus jazz. Like you hear it, you know right. that there's a difference there.
Right. And if you're interested in jazz, like go there. Right. right? And you're like, well, I really like jazz fusion. All right, well, okay, that's this category. Right. Like, and if you like that, you're probably going to like this. That's utilitarian, right? But it's all music. So, you know, yeah, that one's got a little bit more of this. This one's got a little more of that. All right. And so this like gatekeeping of, you know, well, if you're making up this bit, then it doesn't count. I'm just like, you have no leg to stand on. There's no logic to this. This is just you like leveraging your own biases to try and like make the world you. And I have no patience for that.
Right.
So yeah, I gave that speech in inducting. I mean, not in, like as part of the induction ceremony, and it was well received. Hardest speech I've ever given in my life. I've said this numerous times.
Wow.
You know, because he had just died. Harry was front row, right in front of the podium. And, you know, I've given speeches to hundreds of people all the time, like, I'm like, whatever. But man, I was like, I can't look at her because I'll break. Right. Cause you could just see all the emotion she was like holding in and stuff. And it was just like, I can't look at her. I won't be able to keep cool. And so I of course apologized to her numerous times since, like, I'm so sorry I'm giving that speech. I could not look at you. I was talking to you, but I couldn't look at you because like, it was this huge group of people and I couldn't do that. She was like, it's okay. I was crying for both of us. Fair enough. So yeah, I basically took like that speech and the idea of it. And yeah, I incorporated it into the text of this to you know, to kind of again, like, you know, make this okay, you know, just to say, This is an okay thing. Like, you can love this. I mean, I'm like, on the one hand, I'm like, why the hell do you need me to tell you it's okay, right? You shouldn't. but I also know from experience that it does matter to people, right? There is a kind of, you know, this professor said that it's okay, and there's a relief to that, and you know, I would say like you don't need me to tell you something's okay, but. But if it helps, like, awesome, it's okay. You know, like, it's right. good stuff, and be happy with it. Love it. Study it. Like, you know, treat it as Homer, like, go for it. There's no reason not to do that.
Right.
And so, yeah, I'm glad that you thought that defense was good. It certainly came from the heart from my side.
No, you could tell reading the book. I was reading the section on, and actually, let's take a step back quickly and talk about the structure of your book, because this was something okay. that I was not sure what it was going to be going in. And what I found was it was sort of half this prose-based background story, a breakdown of Jordan's writing technique. It even has a full chapter on Tolkien and Jordan, which was really excellent and something that comes up a lot because of the similarities between The Eye of the World and The Lord of the Rings.
I have it in my notes right here. Question mark. Tolkien, Jordan, question mark, question mark.
Right. But as you point out, Jordan sort of takes what Tolkien did and went a step farther. And what I want to know is, how did you go about deconstructing Jordan's writing process to the point where you get to these Arthurian legends that you mentioned and to the point where you can sort of compare and contrast with Tolkien in such detail?
By careful step, this was the thing that, one of the things that drew me to Jordan in the first place. You know, when I was 15 years old and picked up Eye of the World the first time, and even in the prologue, you get these, the one I always mention to people because I think it's fairly recognizable, as a reference to the gates of Paradise. And I'm like, at the age of 15, I was like, that's the gates of paradise, isn't it? Like, I feel like he's up to something. And that kind of drew me in because I'm somebody who likes, you know, puzzles. And here's one of the things I love in my, being a medieval military historian, right? What happened at the Battle of Agincourt? I mean, that's a puzzle, right? You know, I've got clues, pieces, and then I try and coalesce them into a complete picture. And so that the idea that that was something that was happening within these books captivated me. And for years, I've been like sort of doing this in my spare time, as it were. And then giving lectures about kind of what I was seeing at Jordan Con, the convention dedicated to Jordan, at Dragon Con, getting in front of people and, you know, here's what I think he's up to. And obviously seeing, what Shippey and others, had done with Tolkien and, the kind of writing that I was doing with Tolkien, talking about his influences and how he was building things. So like I had a lot of that kind of apparatus already in mind and a lot of those pieces of the puzzle. And he had given a lot of interviews as well, where he would say, somebody would write and say, this looks kind of Arthurian. And he'd be like, yeah, sure is. Like, right. Well done. And so I already had all that in mind. And that was this is what the book is going to be. But then being given full access to the notes, there were notes that were like, and of course, I've talked about many of them in the book. They were like, this character equals that character. This character equals that character. It's pretty good. A smoking gun. I like that. So you could see in his process how he would do this. And then that allowed me in the second half of the book. First half of the book, as you said, I've got a biography of Jordan, a kind of comparison between him and Tolkien. Not comparison, like, one is better than the other, but just like a
right
kind of setting them together, right? Mm-hmm. This is Tolkien's methods. Here's how Jordan kind of built on that model. And then I've got a chapter of his Jordan's writing process, going through the notes, going through like this was the first seed, right? Then he layers in this, then he layers in this. Here's all the drafts and things to walk people through that. And then the second half of the book is a glossary of people, places, items, events that sort of say, like, this is where he got it. The way the Wheel of Time works, it's rarely just one thing, right?
Right.
Randall Thor is doesn't equal King Arthur. Like that's a piece of that puzzle.
Right.
And so, yeah, I had all that stuff. And to have the notes kind of confirming a lot of that, and then from that kind of like reverse engineer, like, this is his process. This is how he did it. And I know he did it here, 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 here. What happens if I put that in place here? Oh, I get this. Well, that's what he did, right? It's really, that's part of the reason I like the Tolkien comp, or, you can find the language behind languages, right? By linguistic methodologies, something that Tolkien was fascinated with in philology. And you can do the same thing with stories, and that's, of course, what Lord of the Rings is. you know, the story behind stories, Jordan's doing the same thing. And so once you see his method in place, it's pretty easy to start spotting it everywhere. And by no means is this book the totality of this. Yeah. It is like the tip of the iceberg of this happening, because he does it all over the place.
All right, we're going to take a quick break and we'll be right back.
I'm not exactly a tech genius, but I knew one thing for sure. If I wanted my small business to crush it, I needed a website that worked like a pro, and I needed it yesterday. Lucky for me, Bluehost made it ridiculously easy. With their AI design tools, building my website was a walk in the park. I could customize, optimize, and monetize everything exactly how I wanted. In just a few minutes, I had a secure site up and running. I couldn't believe how straightforward it was. And getting found online? Bluehost helped me with that, too. I perfected my keywords and meta descriptions with their search engine tools. The AI even gave me suggestions to improve my pages. Now I can sit back, relax, and focus on my customers while my website continues to rank higher and higher on Google. With their 30-day money-back guarantee, I wasn't worried about taking the plunge, and now I'm so glad I did. Head over to Bluehost.com and build something special today.
Now, you mentioned philology. You've described philology in the book in a way that I had not thought of it before, because everyone associates it with language because of who Tolkien was, about the courses he taught, the writings he did outside the Lord of the Rings. And you've sort of expanded it to this love of learning, this broader thing where it includes things like histories and cultures and myth. And then you apply that in a way that makes this glossary make a lot more sense. Because I think if I started with the glossary, it would be useful in giving me trivia, but it would not allow me to fully trace Jordan's mind the way that you have throughout the book. But the way that you've laid out the glossary after this really helps to lead the reader down the path of Jordan's reverse engineering, as you put it.
Yeah, and of course that was very deliberate. Mm-hmm. I know that many people are going to come to the book and are going to go straight to the glossary for particular things, right?
Right.
I mean, I know many, many people are like, first thing I'm doing is finding out who Nakomi is. I'm going to that entry, right? And that's fine. Like, that's live and let live. You know, you ain't hurting anybody, baby. Go for it.
Right.
That said, I wrote it to be read like beginning to end. Because I do think it's important to establish who he is and how he worked, and to establish this mindset of yes, stories, applying linguistic principles to story, which is something Tolkien did, right? I mean, philology means love of learning. That's literally what the word means. And yeah, it got sort of transposed, into linguistics, because that's where it starts with, Sanskrit and the commonalities with Greek and Latin.
Uh-huh.
Back in the day, but certainly Tolkien is trying to view this in story terms, and Jordan is just like, yeah, man, going to go down that rabbit hole, and then adds into it, other writers like Robert Graves, White Goddess, and what he's doing, which is again kind of similar. So, ideally, from my point of view, a reading of the book in which you get through those first chapters, hopefully it's not like through like it was a homework to do, but like you do those before you get into the glossary. Yeah, the glossary will make more sense because now you can see this is how he did it. And I'm just giving you like the final like result of that for each entry, right? I don't trace the entire process in that entry. The book would be too bloody big. But to say like these connect and why, because you know what the process is, right? It certainly is kind of meant to read that way. But I mean, if anybody's listening and wants to do it elsewise, it's fine.
No, I definitely agree with you. It makes more sense going front to back. And it's very interesting because it does feel like sort of two volumes of a book there, where another author might have split this into two books, but they pair so well together that I'm glad that you put this together here.
So yeah. My question, and as our listeners know, I'm an uninitiated in the world of Jordan other than seeing season one on Amazon. It sounds like I could read the first part of the book to understand who Jordan was as an author and sort of these wider contexts. And then I could use the second half, the glossary part, as I'm watching so that I can deconstruct certain elements. And I'm asking as a specific use case as somebody who has not seen anything but season one.
Yeah, I mean, it's always a little bit hard for me to tell because, like, I know it all, right? But
yeah,
I don't want to, like, know it all like I'm a know it all. But
yeah, right, I mean, right, you wrote the book, stuff. Right? Yes, exactly. Yeah.
But I think the first part, I mean, one of the first things I say is, let's say, look, this is full spoilers, like, because you can't really do this without talking about the entirety of the scope of things, right? So yeah, like, just, you know, just for as an example, and I'm not gonna spoil it here or whatever, but you know, even if you're just watching the first season of the show, you know that there's a thing called the last battle that people are worried about. Like I talk about in the entries of the glossary, yeah, I talk about the last battle and how that was constructed and the historical stuff that's used. So in that sense, there's spoilers, obviously.
Okay.
But the prose chapters, the first half of the book, there are spoilers in there in like certain elements of talking about like the drafts, right? You know, he originally planned for the series to kind of come together this way. That's not what happened, but that's kind of what he originally planned. I did try to keep that from being too spoilerific. So I do think you could basically do that, right? You could read the first few chapters and get a really good sense of what the Wheel of Time is about, what it is that Jordan was trying to do, how he was doing it, that could then inform what you're seeing on the screen. I mean, that's, you know, not to say that the Rafe Judkins and everybody else who was involved in that knew this stuff. I've got no idea. They never talked to me, so I don't know.
Well, they should.
as far as I know, they've never accessed the notes or any of that stuff. Boop, so, boop, boop,
boop, boop. Hey, Jeff, yeah, get over, have those guys talk to Michael.
Yeah. But it's still like they're informed by the books and the books are informed by all this. I mean, I still think kind of like the pieces are there and it would be useful, I think, to hopefully I've done my work in explaining to people, even if they kind of didn't come in with a love of the Wheel of Time, why people find this amazing and what it is that Jordan was trying to do that has captivated people.
So would you say that then when the discussions about the, you know, production for this book, was that the brief that you were brought or I don't know how the conversation exactly flowed, but like, what's the purpose of this book or what was the brief? What was the need in the marketplace for this book to be called for?
I think the big one was that nobody had kind of really laid out this kind of additional track. So I almost think about it as like the Wheel of Time is a series. It's not alone in this, but it's to the depth that it is pretty unique, where you have kind of like one surface story, and that surface story is fine. It's complete. It's totally great. But then you can like separate out another track, like another read of it, another understanding of it that is also complete. And those two tracks are working simultaneously. Like it's like left and right channel. You know, they come together into this amazing stereo. But they can be sort of tracked out, and for the most part, everybody's listening to one track, and it's a great track. Like it's an amazing track. There's a reason this is sold. Yeah, I mean, 40 million copies or whatever the hell it's up to now. Like, there's a reason. But hey, as much as you love this, I'm not saying you've been loving it wrong. I'm not saying that what you're doing is,
but yo, check it out underneath here. There's another track going on. Yeah.
Yeah. Check this out. Isn't that cool?
It's like something, it's not like it's missing. I think this is a very bizarre analogy, but like airplane wings have been working for a very, very long time, right? And then suddenly you started seeing those little wing tips on the airplanes, on the big jumbo jets. Yeah. And I was like, oh, this improves the wing. The wing is fine, but yo, this like adds this whole other thing of efficiency and safety and da 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 da.
Yeah. So it's like either way. Isn't this nice that we have this?
This is really cool. Yeah.
Yeah. So that, yeah, same kind of thing, right? You know, cool. Again, and I'm not saying, I mean, you can ignore this fact. It's fine. I mean, I'd love it if you didn't, because I'd like for you to buy my book. But there's no right or wrong way to fan. Like, you can love the wheel time, completely ignore this. Great. Like, fine. But I felt like, you know, when I was giving talks about Jordan and talking about this kind of a little bit, there was always this like, oh my God, you're kidding. Like, what? And I was like, yeah, you know, of course, initially I kind of felt like, isn't this how we all are reading? No? Like, oh, wow. Like, let me share this. And so, yeah, it was definitely what I wanted to get across in the book was this, like, a love of this thing. Some people have called it like a love letter to the fans, and in some like it is in, you know, in my heart, I'm like writing this for y'all. But yeah, I'm trying to sort of hopefully help people understand how awesome the Wheel of Time is. Not to put too fine a point on it, but you know, like, this is amazing stuff. I hope y'all can see that.
Well, you know, if you find yourself listening to a podcast called the Lorehounds Podcast, you probably do want that second layer. So I hope that you will check out Michael's book here, because this is probably your target audience.
Hopefully. And it is, you know, the people that kind of like love Tolkien and love it for this kind of this depth and these connective tissues that he makes, I mean, which certainly is me. You know, there's a reason that I've written those articles, you know, about Tolkien and things, is because I'm fascinated by that. And yeah, this sort of say like Jordan was doing that too, right? And in a way that was respectful, I think, with Tolkien. He's using Tolkien, isn't trying to hide that, right? You know, I mean, there are some authors, I don't throw anybody on the bus, but like copied Tolkien and then like denied it, right?
Right.
No, I didn't.
Martin.
you know, I mean, and there, of course, there's people that have copied Jordan and then have denied it.
Right.
You know, no, I didn't copy that. Sure you didn't, but yeah, here where it's, he's well aware, and you know, the first part of the Eye of the World is straight up Tolkien, right? And intentionally, it's like so intentionally, he's like, I'm gonna do that and then I'm gonna turn you.
When John convinced me to check out Wheel of Time on Amazon, I watched that first episode, and I was just like, oh my God, this is so Tolkien, right? Like, it was just screaming at me, but I had no context that that's what he was doing, that there was some of that imbued, of that spirit imbued into the book, you know, overtly into the books, but then, you know, distilled into the first episode. You can't, you know, you couldn't probably avoid that. So, and then once I got that, then I was like, okay, settle down. It's okay. Like, you know, this guy's doing something, hang with it and see what it brings you.
Yeah. And it's a difficult thing he tried to do, you know, where he thought, let me give you something that's comfortable, something you're used to. You know, we know kind of Tolkien, you know, works. We know we all love it. You know, he loved it. Let me give you that comfort, familiarity. And now let me start like taking you to left field, you know, like it's okay. It's going to be okay.
Which is what John kept selling me on this series is like, no, wait, just see where he goes with this, because you are not going to know where you end up from where you started necessarily.
Right. Yeah. 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 So yeah, I you know, I talk about this in the book too. So hopefully cool. That comes across.
Yeah. I mean, when you're reading The Wheel of Time, you can be in book 13, you can be in book halfway through book 14 and you don't know how it's going to end. So it's, he keeps you on your toes the whole time. One thing I'll say is kind of funny is, you know, Tolkien is known as, at least his original intent was to create this mythology of England. And yet Jordan is the one pulling so much from Arthurian legend. And Tolkien was over with like Kalervo and Beowulf, which, it's just so funny how Jordan was sort of more on the English side. Although you point out, he's got all this stuff from Eastern religions. He's got things from all across the world, which is, I think, something that Tolkien was limited by his very strict adherence to Catholicism in the myths that he pulled from. I think he was comfortable pulling from a lot of myths, but maybe not all, especially those that are tied to religion, modern religion at least. And it's really fascinating to see something like Jordan, where you have this cyclical nature of time. You have this thing that is far removed from the true creation to Armageddon arc that Tolkien was painting. And for you to explore that was really great.
Thank you. It is part of the fun of it. You know, that at any given point, you know, this could be, you know, taking some of the battles, for instance. Right, is his source battle for this something in Vietnam, where he was?
Right.
Is it Alexander the Great? Is it Napoleon? Is it, like, because he did all of them? I mean, he did all those things, and so at any given moment, you really have to be on your toes. And it was, of course, great fun for somebody like me. You know, that my puzzle is not confined, as you said, with, you know, Tolkien. You have a fairly limited range of materials that he's grabbing from. Right. Not to, it's not an impressive range, because it's extraordinary.
Right.
But it is, this is just that, and then so much, like, so much. It's everything. Anything and everything could be in there. And that's daunting, because it is very, like, you know, where have I not looked? And you're like, there's always somewhere else you can look. His library, the last time they did a count of his library, and this was several years before, so he's bought lots of books since, it was 15,000 volumes.
Wow.
Like, he had a lot of stuff. He had a lot of stuff, and he was going through it. So, there's a lot that he used, and that's fun. It's cool.
And speaking of stuff, you talk about the physical objects that he had that he was sort of looking at,
yeah,
while he was writing. Can you just give a brief talk about that? And of course, people should get the book if they want to hear the whole story.
By the book. He would apply the same kind of idea of objects or of kind of stories behind stories or whatever. He would apply that to material culture as well. So the example I give, for instance, of the sword, right? The idea there is that you take this sort of, you know, major sword type of East and West, using those in scare quotes, because there is no East and West, we're on a globe. People can typically think of it. So you got like a katana on one side, and like a hand and half sword. I use example of the Sword of the Black Prince, mainly because it's a fairly famous sword, and I happen to have a replica of it, so made taking pictures easy. To take those two, and he essentially like melds them into a single sword to essentially kind of create a sword that these swords could have come from, right? Or alternatively lead to, right? Because, you know, time, right, being a wheel forecast. That usage of material culture is different. Like Tolkien never really did anything like that. And Jordan's doing that, and even doing that with landscapes. The world itself has that connective tissue. You know, which again, I think is something a lot of people don't really necessarily think about, right? You know, this really is our world. So how does that actually connect? We have the same thing in Tolkien, right? You know, Middle Earth is our Earth. And so, you know, what do you do with that? How do you map it? He's going to the classics there. Why is he going to the classics? He's going to this one. This is why it's tracking out. This is why that maps on the geography. That's cool. Jordan was doing the same stuff.
Yep.
And again, I don't think a lot of people are kind of like listening to that subtrack, or however you want to say that. So he was doing this same process essentially with anything and everything. He just really wanted to get this sense of depth by connecting to our world. And it's fun, right? It's cool to have a character looking in a museum and seeing, you know, the symbol of a luxury car, a hood ornament, and being like, man, that's gaudy. Like, what the hell is that piece of metal about? I can sense the kind of superiority on that, you know, just from across the room. And I don't even know what it is. Right. And we're reading it and being like, oh yeah, man, I hate people who drive that car too, you know? And of course, then it's also interesting then to find out, you know, Jordan's neighbor drove that car. So,
oh, wow. Wow.
Shots fired. Cool. which is another kind of thing I tried to give people a flavor of, that he put things in, like Easter eggs, and also just, you know, you could almost just kind of see the amusement, right? Of hey, here's this. I wonder who's going to catch it. You know, like, I wonder who's going to see it. So, right. Yeah, fun stuff.
And you point out that sort of makes it skirt the line between science fiction and fantasy when he starts putting Easter eggs in.
It's in neither category, because it's in both categories.
Right.
What category do you want it to be in? Obviously, it's marketed as fantasy.
Right.
You know, people are like, well, there's magic. It must be fantasy. Okay.
Star Wars.
Right.
And you have Star Wars. Like, yeah.
Yeah. Like, what are you going to do? So, I mean, those are essentially marketing decisions, and marketing decisions have nothing to do with the work, really.
Right.
Yeah.
Couple of segue questions here, and back into TV realm. I'm curious if you have any thoughts on season one, and then I really want to ask if you've been watching Andor, but you don't have to answer that second one.
I have been watching Andor. And it's really good. It's really good, which is, I'll say, a relief given some of what has transpired with that property.
Right.
I watched season one of Wheel of Time. There were a lot of things I absolutely loved about it. I love that it's bringing people to the books, to this world. I think it's great for people to be aware of this property. And hopefully be moved to read the books, because I think the books are amazing.
Right.
But even if not, like, even if you're just like, I'm just a TV fan of the thing. Like, great. Again, like, fandom, like, do your fandom how you want to do it. Like, rock and roll. So I think it's wonderful in that regard. The casting is marvelous. I'm really, really pleased with the casting. I think they did a fantastic job. And like, top to bottom, like, even things where I was like, that's, you know, at least it doesn't match my headcanon since I was 15. Like, who gives a damn? Like, I whatever. Did they do a good job? Yeah, they did a good job. Great. You know, that's awesome. And Rosamund Pike as Moraine, like, she kills it. I think she's so good. And I'd be saying that even if on the audiobook of Origins, she didn't like say nice things about me. Right. So,
right. Yeah. She does an interview at the end of your audiobook, right?
Yeah. Yeah. She does an interview at the end of the audiobook and says my name. And like, it's legit to have Rosamund Pike say your name. I'll just say that. It's good. It's good. It's good. It's nice. Let's listen to that on loop. The casting is great. I wish that the money that was behind Rings of Power was behind Wheel of Time.
Yeah.
Because
right.
I think one of those properties is a lot stronger in terms of the writing and much else. I think it would have been a good idea, but Jeff Bezos did not ask me. I think it was really good.
One of the things that we did on our during our Rings of Power coverage and a little bit before too, was, you know, we talked about Tom Shippey and something, you know, we're sort of roughly calling the Shippey test, which is the whole, you know, does the medium change the message, that whole dialogue between, are the changes that showrunners and directors have to do they keep you in the storyline, and were, because of the medium, did you have to make certain concessions and changes? And, you know, does that keep you within the core of the message or take you out of the core of the message? I think there was a famous lecture that Tom gave. Tom, listen to me. Professor Shippey, or whatever his official title is, gave, that I listened to like over and over again. It was a really great analysis of that question of like, okay, well, here we have the first three Lord of the Ring movies. They had to do a lot of script changes and character changes to overlay things to make it work for a movie. And so we use that sort of test throughout the Rings of Power to see, like, rather than just go, oh, I hated this, or, oh, that was really good. Like, no, let's actually rationalize this and use a little bit of a framework here and apply some analysis as opposed to just emotional reaction. So if you think of season one of Wheel of Time, end result, do you feel that Amazon kept the core, or did the changes that they had to do for television bend it and shape it so that we're deviating further away from
the changes? I thought that they did make, I thought, were by and large absolutely understandable. There were some where I was like, that's not, I would have solved that problem. But I absolutely recognize the problem that you're solving, right? You know, this is the problem, we've got to solve it. They chose to do it one way. I think that I would have gone another way, but I get entirely what the problem is, and yours is a solution, right? So fine. There wasn't anything that kicked me out in that way. It felt a lot like the Peter Jackson Lord of the Rings, right? You know, I mean, yeah, is like they cut Tom Bombadil. Yeah, so would I. Right. I mean, in terms of what Tolkien's doing, is Tom Bombadil important? Oh my God, yes. Tom Bombadil is absolutely essential. But it's the first cut. It's the first cut I'm making, you know? And
Council of Elrond, right? Like, let's bring that down, right, you know. Right.
I mean, you know, and the second cut I'm making is probably the most important thing in the books in Lord of the Rings to me. The most important thing in those books really is probably the Scouring of Shire. Cut number two. Like, yeah, sucks. But that's what we got to do to, like, kind of make this work as a film. So I thought that this was absolutely the kind of equivalent of that in terms of, yeah, we're going to have to cut this. We're going to have to bring these things together. We're going to have to add this subplot to establish these things that, you know, we slow burned in the books, and we can't slow burn it, right? And we got to do this. Great. I didn't have any problem with any of that. I was really, really pleased with all that. About the only thing that I was like, oh, dang it, is the same thing I'm always mad with in almost any of these films or TV shows, whatever, which is the military stuff. Right. And that's like, I'm a medieval military historian. Like, of course I'm going to be pissed if you got the trebuchet pointed the wrong way. if you're Game of Thrones, like, you know, that's, did you just literally throw away your light infantry? Did you just do that? Like, what did anybody, like, you know, I get that you want drama. I can give you drama, damn it. Like, and do it correctly. Right. Come on. So there's that kind of stuff, you know, where you're like, that's not at all right. And why did you do that? But I'm also like, that's Hollywood. I mean, that's Hollywood, baby. That's how they always are. They don't get it right.
Interestingly, when I was, you know, trying to watch that first season, when I really started to get strong feels and like go, oh wow, I'm really starting to invest in these characters, was apparently a whole cloth created subplot about the death of the warder and the Aes Sedai and that relationship. And that blew me away. I was like, whoa, this is new. I have not seen this before. And that was, John told educated me, was like, that is all show creation as opposed to.
And it's brilliant. It's absolutely brilliant. And again, that's the sort of thing where, you know, the connection between the Aes Sedai and the warders is slow burned in the books. You kind of get pieces of it, you know, and you come to a full understanding of it. And they're like, no, man, you need to understand this. Let's create a subplot that does that. And God, it's good. It's so good. So good. It's probably my favorite episode of the entire series.
It does stuff with gender and grief and ritual. Yeah. It was just beautiful.
If there was one sort of piece of the whole thing, and I don't know who it was in the writer's room who kind of came up with that, but like that would have been the thing that I'd just be like, just high five, like just this is amazing, like nailed it, love it, you know? And again, I'm not a kind of purist or whatever that you know. Yeah. Well, that's not in the books, so it doesn't belong. Like you know, take a hike. You know, like this is it's what it needs to be. I mean, I say it as a purist, and then I am like, you know, the trebuchet should face the right way. I mean, I guess I'm a purist about some things.
That's
not a wheel of time.
Well, again,
that's not a wheel of time error.
Outside of pointing the weapon in the right direction to do its job, that's really where I like to bring in this whole sort of shippy test thing, which is like, okay, I can have an emotional reaction to this. I can like it or dislike it. But I can understand that the showrunner has a studio on their back who has finances on their back, where they have production schedules, actor schedules. We had COVID throwing a huge wrench into the works for a whole lot of productions. And so being able to sort of analyze that a little bit more carefully, as opposed to just going, well, you know, I feel this way or I feel that way. Oh, your feelings are great. You know, those are your feelings. But let's think about it. Let's step it back a little bit and think about what are the practical implications that they were dealing with to solve, as you say, these different problems.
Yeah, exactly.
So before we let you go, Michael, what's next for you after completing this monumental work?
What's next for me? So this month, we're recording this here in early to mid-November. Mm-hmm. This month, I've got a book due on the Battle of Agincourt. Again, I'm a medieval military historian, kind of like a trade. And I had a book come out in July on the Battle of Crecy. Did very well. It's doing very well. And this is kind of a follow-up to it. So it's a popular account of, you know, for anybody of what happened at Agincourt. Like, and what I think really happened, as opposed to, you know, these are the stories of Agincourt. This is the myth of Agincourt. I'm like, no, sorry. Here's what I think happened. And here's why. I'm always very invested in I don't want to lecture on the end result of my work. I want to bring people into how I got there, into the journey of it.
Show your work.
My work. Yeah. Be as completely transparent. Like, and look, if I get something wrong, like, here's my work. Like, show me where it was wrong. Because I don't, as I always say, I don't want to be right. I want to get it right.
I like that distinction.
I mean, it's what we should all be after. I'm not sure we all are, but you know.
No, there's a strong desire for humanity for a human being to be in the right, to avoid being wrong, right? Like that's
right.
It
leads to all kinds of problems.
Yeah.
I got the Battle of Agincourt book comes out next year. Again, I got to finish it in a week or 2 weeks, whatever. Not done yet, but it's getting there if my editor's listening. And then a couple months after that, I'm going to be turning in a book on the battles of Thermopylae. So that's looking at the most famous battle, 480 BC, the Spartans, 300, etc. There are way more than 300 Spartans there.
and that is a mythology that certainly has taken root in certain parts of our American culture.
Oh God, yes. So I go through that myself and my co-author, Michael, would go through that. Here's the reality, like on the ground, right? You know, reconstructing that from the ground up, but it's really a biography of place. So the book's called The Killing Ground. So we do the Battle of Thermopylae, 480. Well, that's like the second of, I forget what our count is of the number of battles that happened there. Like there's a World War II, like Nazi tank battle that happens at Thermopylae. And so, you know, just saying like, look, here's this ground, you know, as we say, this may be the bloodiest ground on the planet.
Wow.
Given the number of battles that have happened over time, you know, why do they keep happening here? And, you know, what can we sort of glean from that about, you know, military history, even different succeeding generations of technologies and personnel fighting on the same ground? How do they change it? So got that book to do. And then after that, so that's due in January. After that, I've got a break.
Okay.
So I've been putting out like 3-4 books a year, and
that is a pace. That is a pace to be reckoned with. You are the opposite of Tolkien, it seems.
Well, Tolkien was writing like crazy. Let it out.
Right. Yeah.
Holding it all back.
Well, I'm glad that you're able to send it to your editor.
Yeah. Well, my editor will be glad too. The next book that'll come out will actually be a novel, be the third book of the Seaborn series that comes out. That's fantasy. I think that comes out in the spring. So, I'm doing stuff.
You are.
I'm doing stuff.
There's plenty to read from you, no matter what you're looking for. If you're looking for medieval studies, if you're looking for Wheel of Time commentary, if you're looking for fantasy, it sounds like people can find your work on your website, which will drop in the description of the podcast. As well
that.
As, you know, if you Google Michael Livingston, you will find him. He's there. So
I like your Twitter handle at medieval guy.
Medieval guy. Yeah, my students, you know, of course, you know, my cadets, right? They find it so like, wow, you're Googleable. Not really the accomplishment you think it is, guys, but yeah, you can Google me and find all kinds of stuff. Yeah.
Very cool. Well, thank you very much, Michael. This is Dr. Michael Livingston of the Citadel, author of Origins of the Wheel of Time, the legends and mythologies that inspired Robert Jordan. Thank you so much for your time, and we hope to talk to you again soon.
All right. Thanks for listening to that interview with Michael Livingston. We really had a great time talking with him. Quick reminder that as soon as Amazon gives us a release date, John and I will kick into gear and plan our coverage for Wheel of Time Season 2. We're really excited about the season and looking forward to it. We're just waiting on Amazon. Another quick couple of program reminders at the time of this recording. We've got White Lotus Episode 7 releasing next Wednesday. That'll be the final episode. And then a week later, this on Wednesday, we'll have our season wrap-up podcast for White Lotus Season 2. It's been a great season, super entertaining. It's like skiing. The more you get pointed downhill, the faster it goes. It's been a lot of fun. Following the White Lotus Season 2 Episode 7 podcast, we're going to be having the first of our new podcasts covering the MCU. We're calling it the MC Universe. I'm going to be talking to my buddy Jean, not John, about sort of a meta context of the Marvel Cinematic Universe. We're going to talk about some of the broader themes, some of the different characters. We're looking at it from a sort of a higher altitude down, sort of a 10,000 foot view of what's going on in the MCU. After that, we'll have the White Lotus season wrap. The week of Christmas, we have 3 podcasts coming out. We've got our second breakfast. We're going to release that on Christmas Day as a special bonus to everyone. Normally, that's a Patreon exclusive, but we're going to make that available for everyone as a nice little gift. And then on December 28th, we'll have the next installment in our covering of the Star Wars franchise. John and I are going to be talking about Tales of the Jedi. We're going to be picking up any last bits of Andor feedback. So if you still have some thoughts and feelings, send those in right away so we can get those covered in the that podcast. And then we're going to be talking about our general ideas about the Star Wars franchise as it is. I've been watching The Bad Batch. John has finished Rebels and is getting into some more of the animated stuff. So we're really getting ourselves geared up for The Mandalorian, which will be coming back in March. And then on December 31st, we're going to have the second episode in our Silmarillion Stories series. We're going to be covering the Valenquenta. So if you're a Tolkien fan, grab your books, read that next chapter. We're going to be talking with noted Tolkien scholar, Marilyn Arpakila. If you might remember, she's been on a bunch of our podcasts when we were covering the Rings of Power. We're excited to have her back. We had her on our Andor season wrap. So she's coming in to help us talk through the Valenquenta. All right, we've got lots going on more. We've got some plans in January, and we'll update you when we have those. Thanks for listening.
The Wheel of Time podcast is produced by the Lorehounds and published by Bald Move. You can send questions and feedback to WOT@thelorehounds.com. You can get ad-free and early versions of these episodes at patreon.com/thelorehounds. Any opinions stated are ours personally and do not reflect the opinion of or belong to any employers or other entities. Thanks for listening.
I'm not exactly a tech genius, but I knew one thing for sure. If I wanted my small business to crush it, I needed a website that worked like a pro, and I needed it yesterday. Lucky for me, Bluehost made it ridiculously easy. With their AI design tools, building my website was a walk in the park. I could customize, optimize, and monetize everything exactly how I wanted. In just a few minutes, I had a secure site up and running. I couldn't believe how straightforward it was. And getting found online? Bluehost helped me with that, too. I perfected my keywords and meta descriptions with their search engine tools. The AI even gave me suggestions to improve my pages. Now I can sit back, relax, and focus on my customers, while my website continues to rank higher and higher on Google. With their 30-day money-back guarantee, I wasn't worried about taking the plunge. And now I'm so glad I did. Head over to Bluehost.com and build something special today.